The following is intended only for mature audiences. Discretion advised.
We're going to do this under 2 minutes.
You take as long as you need to. I'm going to contribute as little as possible, to be honest with you.
Why?
Because I hate this issue. I hate it both. It's a shitty two-part story. I can't stand it.
Well, I mean, there's not a whole lot to it, man.
I know. Well, except for the fucking first page where there's a goddamn novel. What is it? It's like almost all black, except for the little bitty picture of Violator in front of all the kids. And then text.
But of course, that's just catching you up. So if you forgot, I'm assuming this book
is literally a third of the page is nothing but white text on a black
background. I'm assuming maybe the book was running a little late, and maybe if the book was off and you kind of forgot a little bit, they were like, "Here's a quick recap."
Now, there's nothing quick about that shit. That's a short story right there.
No, basically, honestly, I think it's the script from the first book. They just wrote it down again. They just put the script in the corner, like they'll figure this shit out. So, welcome all boys and girls to the Violator's Den, where we're reading about Spawn number 15, and the Violator is still telling his story of how he encountered medieval Spawn. Of course, it's a twisted Violator tale, so he's
the
hero.
Yeah.
Spawn is not.
Outright lies to you. They're clearly shown because the pictures are telling one story and Violator's telling another. Or technically it's the clown because he's in his human, he's currently trapped in human form.
Form still, yes. But he's telling the kids about how, you know, he fought the medieval Spawn. At the end of the last issue, he had given him the flaming blow, which had, he assumed, destroyed the Spawn.
Yeah, completely evaporated.
Yeah, and so he goes on, I guess, to draw out. He thinks that the Spawn might still be alive. So to draw him out, decides he's going to torture his love interest.
Well, it's unclear because I remember it was a big point that medieval Spawn's sister was important to him in the Neil Gaiman story. And Violator claims that this is his evil witch mother, but she's obviously a younger woman. So I don't know if it's his sister or love interest.
Yeah, I was kind of confused on that. And then all of a sudden, the Spawn appears naked as a jaybird, chops off his finger with the special Spawn sword he created. Because he does mention how it's
a sword, right?
Yes.
He is naked, so I don't know. Maybe Spawn's, you know.
If it is, it's shiny and it's John Holmes size.
Everything else is spiky on a Spawn.
So yeah, so true. He's swinging John Holmes here. So they're starting to battle. And of course, the Violator is talking about how he's got him on the ropes. I mean, it's basically, I'm not going to get goaded in. But he's giving grandeur to the truth that is so false that...
Oh, I already know who you're talking about then. He's selling himself as such a great warrior and everything.
Yes.
Where the pictures clearly show that he's getting his ass kicked by naked medieval Spawn.
You definitely get the idea that he's lying. So the actual visual artwork shows you he's getting his ass handed to him. But in his version of the story, he's this great warrior who's drawing out the Spawn, who's just about to finish this battle. And as they're battling, he's coaxing him, telling him, you know, when I'm done with you, what I'm going to do to her, and really trying to get inside his head. And of course, the Spawn is not feeling this shit. So he's going to town on him. And the Violator, as they're battling, forgets that the Spawn had a costume that is a symbiote. And the costume jumps into the fight as well and attacks the Violator, which then gives the Spawn the upper hand. And as they're battling, basically cuts the fucker's head off, removes the Violator's head. And the Violator now, he's talking about how he is the birth of the dragon, that they had envisioned him as green and scaly. And
oh, the Violator was the mythological basis for the myth of the dragon.
Yes.
Even though it's medieval Spawn, I think dragons predate medieval Spawn the times by quite a bit.
Really?
Yeah. Isn't like dragons like an ancient Chinese lore?
I don't know.
Like,
I don't know. You're about to frank it right now, so I was just waiting.
No, I'm just saying. I think it's another lie of the Violator. Okay. The point I'm making.
And so the Violator has then now been vanquished. The Spawn looks over to, again, sister love interest? Not sure yet. Sister girlfriend or something like that. I don't know. Just really weird.
Whichever. She's as afraid of Spawn as she was of the Violator and goes running away, leaving medieval Spawn more isolated than ever. And the psychological tumult that causes him validates the attack of the Violator, and Malbolge ends up rewarding him for fucking with Spawn's head. Then we flash back to the present where the clown's story has been rejected by the kids who call him a liar and loser and walk away. And then a newspaper hits him in the face. There's a reference in the front of the paper that Petey kills Toddy, ouch, which is a reference to the public debate that Todd McFarlane and Peter David engaged in. I think it was at San Diego Comic-Con, where they were fighting over the creation of Image Comics and how Image could have done a better job. Todd did not make a very good case for himself and was pretty much totally owned by Peter David. It's an in-joke. We can skip past that. Violator is irritated to find that Don Vito, aka Tony Twist, but you know, because of the lawsuits, they had to change the name retroactively, blames do-gooders like Youngblood types or Shadowhawk inspired Wacko, and the clown is offended that he's not getting credit for killing off all those mobsters in the early issues of Spawn, so he decides he's going to play Don Vito a visit, which sets up the Violator miniseries that's coming up.
As this occurs, we find Al in the alleyway behind a restaurant. Some guy walks up and starts to harass him for,
I told you guys not to hang out of my stoop, you homeless bum, blah blah blah.
No, something about scraps. And,
oh yeah, trying to get scraps, yeah, out of the trash and stuff.
And Al was like, well, I didn't realize there was a position to protect scraps. And the guy's like, smart ass, and starts to beat the shit out of Al. And of course, he's going through this whole mental game where, you know, he was taught that sometimes a strategic retreat is just as
effective as a confrontation. For
confrontation, yes. But after a few moments, says, fuck that, and goes to work on the guy a little bit. Has the guy on the floor, grabs a board, snaps it, and describes how at this point he could have jammed it through his eyes to his brain and watched it all leak onto the ground. From this point on, this guy's going to respect him. And the guy says, so you need to leave pronto. Guy screams, yes, sir, takes off. And that's when, I guess, Al becomes more territorial of the alleyway.
This is my alleyway now, motherfucker.
Yeah.
And he runs around with a hunk of wood, which seems very reminiscent of the
Junkyard Dog
figure.
I was thinking Junkyard Dog. Okay,
well, yeah, but I was thinking the Spawn action figure had the board that he...
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And then, of course, we're then treated to the last page where Terry's receiving a phone call and he's being threatened about him being a rat. And they described his wife and how she's wearing a nice negligee and his little daughter. And he's pissed off. You son of a bitch. But they're basically just using his family as leverage against him. And that's where we kind of leave off. And of course, we're notified that Grant Morrison will be writing the next three issues, which I'm excited to read.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Me too. I think Morrison, especially because I'm aware of one concept that originates during the Morrison run that I've been very excited to read about because it's very intriguing to me.
Okay.
So I don't want to go too much into it, though.
All right, man. Go ahead and start franking it.
Okay, so that's Spawn.
I thought you were going to frank it a little bit, man. Get a little Frank sauce.
Days of Image, there is a real strong attempt to have great interconnectivity, to not just sell a bunch of individual titles, which is something that was done in past independent efforts, but it was always a bunch of islands. You weren't getting a whole universe, you were just getting American Flag and Dread Star and Grimjack and what have you. So they wanted to make sure that this is not only a superhero universe, just like what you had over at Marvel and DC, but that they're all connected, they all tie in, there's a reason to buy all the books and not just pick your favorite guy and read that book. And you saw some of that in the ongoing series, but a lot of it was reserved for kind of like side projects and the like. And it seems to me, even more than Youngblood, one of the core linking mechanisms for the early Image universe was the team Operation Nightstrike. And we're going to address that somewhat today. I'm going to go over a little bit of a timeline, and I'm going to use a number of books. It's going to include the two-issue Battlestone miniseries, Youngblood issue number 0, Youngblood Strike file number 1-3, the Youngblood Genesis miniseries. So these are all going to tie in. Our story's going to start in the 1930s, where Michael Stone dismisses his wife's concerns about their older son, Johnny, bullying the younger brother, Cabot. If you haven't put it together, John Annex Stone is Battlestone, and Cabot is going to be the leader of Bloodstrike in the future. Okay. I know we haven't really talked about Bloodstrike yet, but just know that you've got those two brothers. The only one we really have to worry about, for the most part, is going to be John Stone, though. So then we look at the April 93 cover dated Youngblood Strike file number 1. There is an ally story by Rob Liefeld and Danny Meekie. Danny Meekie was the inker. Youngblood Strike file strikes me as, if not Image team up, at least extreme extreme team up. Because if you think about it, you had the Chapel story on one side of the book, and that's a team up between Chapel and Spawn, or Proto Spawn, Al Simmons. And then the other side, you've got the Allies, which is a team set in 1944 Berlin, which consists of Die Hard, the original Golden Age hero, apparently, who I think was supposed to be human. I think he's supposed to be like sort of a Captain America analog with a shield and everything, and a Cobra Commander mask. You've got Glory, who's clearly Wonder Woman.
When I read this, I remember thinking, is this just Captain America hanging out with the JLA?
It's the Invaders.
Wasn't that with the original Human Torch, the android?
Yeah, see, the Invaders as a team concept was created in the 1970s by Roy Thomas. And all the Image guys, but especially Liefeld, read Roy Thomas's material. And so the Invaders was a cooler name for All-Winter Squad. They were the All-Winter Squad, right? And that was Timely's team that was like the Justice Society of America. But because Timely never had as many good characters back then as DC had, they couldn't form a whole society. So the All-Winter Squad was just like Cap, Human Torch, and Namor. And then like their sidekicks to a lesser degree, Bucky, Toro, and also some hangers-on would sometimes, I guess, rotate into there. When Roy Thomas decided he wanted to do 1940s stories in the 1970s, he created the Invaders as a more all-inclusive team that more resembled the Justice Society. So he got brought in like the Whizzer, and I think they created Spitfire to get a female member in there, that kind of bullshit. So this was basically Liefeld trying to do Roy Thomas. But he also didn't have that burden of a selection, because besides Die Hard and Glory, he brought in Super Patriot from the Savage Dragon book. Mm-hmm. And you remember Super Patriot?
Yeah, he's the one that, and he's almost murdered, right?
Well, we'll get to that. Okay. But what happens in the actual story set in 44?
I mean, it's pretty solid artwork.
You basically have Cap, Superman, and Wonder Woman beating up Nazis.
And setting up what I assume was like the first superhero team of the Image Universe.
Well, doesn't Glory eventually become kind of a bureaucrat?
I read the Glory series when it was coming out, but it's been so long I don't remember the details. In this story, though, she's running around dressed up in business attire, yeah, with glasses and her hair tied back.
Yeah, so I just...
Do you want to describe Glory, too, since this is the first time we've talked about her in the comics?
She is a... Well, I mean, Rob Liefeld draws them all pretty much the same. She looks like Tidal Wave. She looks like just with white hair.
Okay, so she like has white hair, and she's got a bustier, and she kind of looks like Wonder Woman.
Let's be honest. His character development, not real strong. Like, if he draws a woman, they all look pretty much the same. Just different color hair, different color costume.
They're all very white, too.
Yes.
Yeah. Long-legged Barbie dolls. Yes. Now, the debut of Glory, who's going to be a pretty major character in the Extreme Studios sphere. There's a two-page pinup by Liefeld in the issue.
Oh, the cheesecake picture? Or her body dimensions are kind of weird, because... So she has a normal size head. I'm thinking double D's, maybe?
At least. Those are perhaps the largest breasts I've ever seen on a relatively mainstream.
Her breasts are literally the size of her head. Yeah. They are the size of her head.
Well, I think larger.
Her torso is kind of weird.
Mm-hmm. Well, she's very lean.
Yeah, but it's kind of weird. And then she, you know, her legs. I mean, look at the body. Does that look normal?
As cheesecake pinups go, I like it fairly well. I especially like the coloring. I really like the skin tones they use on her and stuff. And I think that given that I've seen Liefeld try to do cheesecake in the past and it's not really his forte, this is probably one of, if not the best, examples of him doing cheesecake that I've ever seen. The dimensions are idiosyncratic, what you'd expect from Liefeld. But I think for what it is, it's a nice drawing. And I especially like the coloring. But I think it's especially hilarious that her breasts are just so ridiculously oversized. That had to be intentional. It makes Power Girl look like an A cup. And yeah, the whole thing with Power Girl was that Wally West, in every one of her appearances that he drew, was making her breasts bigger and bigger until the editors made him stop. So this is a clear example of what happens when you don't have an editor, because her breasts are about as big as Die Hard.
I just, for some reason, pictured Mike Myers' character from the Saturday Night Live, Simon, when he's in the tub and doing his drawings. And they're like cartoonish. Yeah, yeah, it's very cartoonish. Like, she's very, what'd you say, Looney Tunes? Big boob, big butt.
Maybe if we're talking about like a Wolf and Red kind of situation, yeah, like a Tex Avery. Yeah. And once again, this Liefeld motif is she's got a very basic costume that doesn't so much have images in the mix, but just like shapes, like geometric shapes, and red and white. Red and white seems to be like his color scheme du jour.
Well, I mean, he kind of called it for, I mean, apparently from what I've been told and seen, the white hair is a fashion statement right now, where people are actually dyeing their hair white.
More silver.
Is it silver?
It's more silver than white. Because a lot of times it'll be like a light blue.
I mean, well, I guess you could say her hair is silver as well.
You could say it, but really it's white, I would say.
But I notice a lot of his characters, their hair is white. Isn't Battlestone's hair white? And
yep, and Supreme has the same color scheme of red and white, yeah, with white hair. Shaft has a red and white color scheme, so it's just a thing with him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty much it. We're just introducing these characters. I'm assuming they were going to be the holy trinity of his young blood world.
Sort of, but it, It's interesting, though, because this is an Eric Larson character in Super Patriot. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the story, you have Glory approaching the Youngblood team and telling them what has happened to Super Patriot in the Savage Dragon title. Now you should probably tell what happened to him.
He was caught in his human form and beat almost to death.
Where he actually lost limbs. Limbs, and stuff.
Yeah. And so cybernetics... Cyber data.
See, that is a thing that's really weird and confusing too. Okay. God, I wish there were editors. You've got Cyber Data, who are the corporation that appears in the Cyberforce book that is responsible typically for turning cyborgs out of people on the good side and the bad side.
Okay.
Cyberforce is the team that gets away from Cyber Data and gets their head screwed on straight and then tries to defeat Cyber Data since they're a criminal organization and that they are terrorist supporters as well.
And then we have...
But then you also, over at the Extreme Universe, you have CyberNet, which is a covert terrorist organization that the public doesn't know about, but that Extreme Studios characters are fighting from the beginning of their universe. So it gets really super confusing.
And then at Dark Horse, we have Skynet. That is, seems like there's a lot of Skynet, cyber.
Yeah, exactly. Too much cybering going on back in the 90s. Another problem I have, though, is that since two of the cybers come from Silvestri, it's like if Silvestri were doing G.I. Joe, the opposing team would be I.G. Joe. Or they'd both be Cobra, but one would be Cobra Gold and one would be Cobra Copper. And it's like, well, which one's which?
No. You'd have Cobra, Black Mamba, Copper. Head. They could roll that.
So CyberNet isn't relevant yet, but they will be. Cyber Data is the Mark Silvestri creation. They're the ones who took Super Patriot after he was nearly killed in Chicago and turned him into a cyborg, which is what he's most familiar for in the Image Comics universe. So in the successive issues, the other two parts of the Die Hard story, because what's weird too is that Die Hard is the only one who goes after Super Patriot. And even though there's dialogue that says that Glory is there helping him, all we ever see throughout the next two issues is Die Hard. Die Hard at this point is the robot version or the android or the cyborg. It's really not clear yet. All we know is that he's not supposed to be the original Golden Age Die Hard. And so Die Hard is going after Shock Troops, which are the villains from Cyberforce again. Okay. Those are the Gestapo forces that the Cybernetic Corp uses. And so he beats up a bunch of those until he finally runs into Super Patriot, and he has a 2-issue long fight with Super Patriot. He finally manages to beat him, and then he takes him into Youngblood to be deprogrammed. The government at this point sees him as an asset. The Youngblood people, like Graves, I think is in the issue, are like, great, we've got him now, this is gonna be good. And then Die Hard and Shaft are like, maybe we fucked up by bringing him back here. But that's sort of the end of that story. But again, it's interesting to me that Strike File seemed to have been set up initially as sort of like a focal point for the Image universe where all the concepts were appearing together. Whereas in the individual titles, you didn't see as much crossing over. But it also goes to show you that through the Allies, you have this connection between the Image universe. Like, Liefeld can't really do Golden Age Adventures without asking Eric Larson to borrow one of his characters, for instance. Yeah. So then we go into the November 1994 Battlestone number one. The miniseries is by Rob Liefeld plot, Eric Stevenson script, Marat Michaels pencils, and Alve inks. Before we start talking about the events, you were not happy with the artwork, you said.
No.
Marat Michaels is a guy who's done some commissions for me. I like his art, but this was still sort of in his younger days, and he wasn't quite as polished as he would get. But what I love about these two issues is the inks. I think Alve is a fucking beast. I think Alve is one of the great underrated inkers in all of comics. He's one of my absolute favorite inkers. And I think that there's an energy. There's a, like, it's a crackling. It's like there's so much fucking sharp line work in this thing that every image just like crackles with that sort of Art Adams kind of quality to it. And so even though it's not as developed as it needs to be, I think that the inks really bring up the game in the artwork. So I'm sorry to see here that you didn't like the artwork too much. But anyway, the important parts to this story for our discussion today is that the Allies expanded to include Roman and Battlestone. Now, do you have any familiarity with Roman?
Isn't there? That's their Namor character, yeah. Right?
Well, not just that, but what's Roman backwards?
Namor? Oh, wow.
I think that was actually Bill Everett that had come up with that, and so Liefeld just flipped it back again. So yeah, that's their Submariner. Then you have Battlestone, who's just sort of like a dude. He's, I guess, they're kind of like their movie Bucky. He has enhanced abilities by this point, I think. They're a regular dude who runs around with a gun and helps them out. But in the context of the story, what happens is that he joins the team. He's a young, brash guy. And the problem is the team leader is Die Hard, but he's following the instructions of Glory because he's got the hots for Glory. There's even a panel where he's checking out her ass as she's telling him something she wants him to do. He's supposed to be covering Super Patriot's back. He goes on this initiative for Glory, so Super Patriot gets nailed by like a tank. And he survives okay, but because he's injured, Die Hard fires Battlestone seemingly on the spot. If you read the story, it looks like the battle's wrapped up very quickly. So maybe he waits until after the battle's over with, but he dismisses him. Roman tries to say, no, you're being impulsive. I know the kid's a little raw and he didn't listen to orders, but that's no reason to throw him off the team. And Diehard's like, nah, I'm done with you. And Battlestone's like, fine, I understand, I'm out of here. And so he walks to his tent and strips off his uniform and tells the regular soldiers around him he's not to be disturbed. So it sort of sets up this tendency in Battlestone to be very impulsive and very aggressive. So then we jump to the 1970s in the Youngblood Genesis miniseries, which you read. In that book, we meet young Alex Grave in high school as he's bullied over his crush on a girl named Nicole, who may be the future Vogue, because he calls her the same, like, Nikki, short version of the name that he calls Vogue at another point in that miniseries. I'm not sure, though. So Grave's counter is by framing the quarterback boyfriend on drug charges and blackmails him with pictures of with a cheerleader to clear his path to Nikki. And then later still, the quarterback named Temple, who I think is the guy who's going to end up running Bloodstrike, is forced to work as Graves' minion. So then we got to go back to stories we already read, set in 1978, Chapel, when he's supposedly getting bullied, and that kind of makes him become Chapel when he sees this bully with a skull face painted on him in Halloween. Now, I got to tell you, Chapel's timeline is fucked regardless, but in particular, Mahal Mayberry's attempt to do a timeline makes no fucking sense. Because if the kid in 1978 that's supposed to grow up to be Chapel, he's like 8 to 12 years old, right?
Okay.
No, am I mistaken? You read those stories too?
Yeah, it's been a while since I read them.
So he's supposed to already be active as a mercenary by 1983 in other stories. So there's no way in that time frame this kid would have grown up, become this muscle-bound badass, and learned the skills you need to be running a mercenary team. So that 1978 date makes no sense. And if you look at it, none of Paul Mayberry's dates in the two-page backups from Bloodstrike Brutalist make any sense. So you kind of have to throw those dates out. But it still gives you a little bit of a parallel between Graves and Chapel, right? Okay. So then we get to around 1981-ish, and that's when Al Simmons presumably was saving Ronald Reagan from John Hinckley Jr. It gets a little muddy because in the cartoon, they claimed that Al Simmons took a bullet for the president, and then Chapel proceeded to kill the assassin, which is not what happened with John Hinckley Jr. But given the time frame that's set up and the fact that Al is supposed to save a president, it would probably have to be Reagan. So then we go to 1983, and that's where Chapel leads the successful but costly Nicaraguan mission to eliminate Colonel Black from the two-issue Chapel miniseries.
Okay.
Then we go to 1984. That's supposedly when he's a young project candidate suggested by Colonel John Stone. It suggests that he's probably already on the X7 series. It gives him his enhanced abilities. Again, I don't think that date makes sense, though, because the young project would presumably be Youngblood, and John Stone is already in his full Battlestone regalia with the skull headpiece and the ponytails and everything else. So I don't think that's accurate, but I do think that maybe John Stone was the guy who was pushing for Chapel to join Youngblood at one point in time. What we can be more certain of in 84, if I recall correctly from reading Spawn issues, that's the year that Wanda Blake married Al Simmons after meeting him at a Republican National Convention. Okay?
Okay.
So you see how important Operation Night Strikes is so far to the timeline we have for all these interactions within the Image universe in the early days. So then we get to 1986. By that point, Bruce Stinson and Al Simmons have already become buddies, and they're operating in Detroit. Now, I was saying in the Chapel episode that I thought they were acting as vigilantes, but I didn't actually have physical copies of the Operation Night Strike miniseries at that point. I was just pulling stuff off the internet to fill in the gap. It turns out they'd already both been working for the military. Hal had already been a national hero for saving the president by that point, was already married by that point. So I don't know why they were in Detroit, unless maybe that's where Bruce Stinson is from. And they're certainly not vigilantes. They were just maybe, you know, two badasses who happened upon this guy they knew getting his liquor store stuck up. And they decided to jump their motorcycles through this guy's window and beat the shit out of the gang. And that's where they are confronted by John Stone, who is there specifically to recruit Bruce Stinson into his new Operation Night Strike project. And that's when Bruce Stinson insists that his buddy Al also has to join in. Whereas if you remember from the Chapel micro story in Brutalists, the person that the young project wanted was Simmons, and they couldn't get him.
Okay.
If you play around with Mayberry's timeline and you push the young project up into the further into the 80s, it would make sense because Al Simmons would still be somebody that they'd want to recruit for Youngblood and would still be working with Operation Night Strike by that point in time. But since Al was becoming a goody two-shoes and trying to kind of get away from some of that stuff, it almost makes more sense for him to have joined Youngblood instead, but that's not how things worked out. Although that could be a motivation for why they would kill Al Simmons, because if they didn't want Al Simmons to go into the Youngblood project, that'd be one way to keep the secrets if they thought he was going to turn on them once he was outside of Operation Night Strike. You know, that's something I don't think they ever touched on as a possibility. Now we're in 1986, and we're looking at the Operation Night Strike miniseries. So Operation Night Strike, it begins with a May 1995 cover date. It's written by Brian Whitten, whose main comic book contributions was writing Chapel projects. He wrote, I think, the first miniseries, and he wrote the ongoing series that spun out of it. Drawn by Richard Ori, who you may remember as the co-creator of Infinity, okay, who we did a spotlight episode on. And then Jaime Mendoza is the inker. He's actually still working. It seemed like he did a lot of work over Chris Bachalo. And I think Al Vey actually does Bachalo as well, so it's weird that both of these guys that were extreme dudes ended up working with that same guy. But I really liked Jaime Mendoza's inks on this book. Richard Ori, though, if you're complaining about Martin Michaels, Richard Ori is going to really put you in fits because his proportions, he does some nice like crosshatchy kind of 90s type shit, but his dimensions on these characters are fucked.
Oh man, what is up with these bodies? It's like a lot of body dysmorphia going on here. I mean, it looks like anatomy wasn't on the top of their list of what our art should show.
It feels late 90s Liefeld that people make fun of for stuff like Captain America.
No, this is what we make fun of. This is when I hear people make fun of Image Comics, this is the artwork exactly what they're making fun of. Big muscles, big hands, weird heads, long necks. Oh, a little TNA, but even they're kind of deformed. What's up with, dude, that thigh? Jesus, dude, the thigh is the same. It's the same proportion as his body.
It looks like a double watermelon, especially with that green pants he's wearing.
Oh my God, his artwork is horrible.
The book was released on June 15th, 1995, which was the same month as Spawn number 32 and the Wildstorm Rising crossover. And it takes place, of course, after the Chapel microseries. So you've got Alexander Graves, who is a white dude with white hair in a suit, which is, again, something that pops up a lot in Rob Liefeld books, and sometimes it's hard to tell these dudes apart. He's the guy who comes with the idea of coming up with a special missions black ops force and starts putting the team together around Battlestone, since he is this guy who's been active as a government agent apparently since World War II. They say that there's a guy who's up for the team named Hogan Reif. He was rejected, and I don't know if that guy ever appears in anything ever again, has anything to do with anything. I'm curious to know if he pops up somewhere. Yeah. So then we go to Detroit, Michigan on February the 12th, 1986. That's where Chapel and Al Simmons are recruited. My question, though, I've yet to see when Bruce Stinson and Al Simmons met each other and became best buddies. And I'm wondering under what circumstances that happened. Because if Al has already saved the president before we really see Chapel going off on his mercenary missions, then he's already a star by that point. And so I'm wondering what brought those two guys together. So then the scene moves to Chicago, where Duke gets recruited. Do you remember Duke?
Roughly.
He's the dude from Youngblood Strike File that Al Simmons ends up executing as a traitor.
Okay.
And in the context of the story, the main thing that is defining about him, he's running around in John Lennon circular sunglasses. He has a white crop top haircut, and he's sort of erudite, tries to smooth things over before he goes into full kick-ass mode, and he seems to be a little bit more articulate than most anybody else that he's working with. Then we go to LA, and we meet a masked second story man named Jake Dutch Holland. So this guy's a thief. He climbs up the sides of buildings and robs them and comes back out again. He gets caught by Battlestone and forced onto the Night Strike team, or else he's going to go to prison or possibly just be killed right there on the spot, since there are a bunch of men with guns around him.
Suicide Squad.
Sort of, kind of, yeah. In this specific case, it seems like. Then you have Vegas, where we meet freeloading whoremonger Fraley, who I assume is named after the ace Fraley from Kiss. And he's a dude with long blonde hair and a goatee, soul patchy kind of thing. Again, he's trying to fuck whores in Vegas without paying for them, which isn't how whoring works from my understanding. I'm pretty sure that's a cash up front kind of gig. Maybe not in Vegas. Maybe in Vegas you can kind of work something else out.
I have a friend with a story. Trust me.
It's a thing. Okay. So because he hasn't been paying his bills, I guess their pimp tries to beat him to death. And instead, Stone shows up, gives him a wad of 20s, and sends him on his way to make up for the damages from when he tried to kill Fraley, and then recruits Fraley on to Night Strike.
Now, let me ask you, writing this book, is it a seasoned writer?
It's the guy who writes Chapel stories. So that's pretty much his entire career, was writing stuff like this. So not seasoned, but having read the story for the standards of Image and indie comics as a whole, he was fine. I didn't hate reading the story or anything, but it wasn't anything special either.
I hated just looking at it. Yeah. So
it was comparable to what Marvel and it was doing at the same time period. So
I don't know. You gave me Genesis, and that's kind of the bar that I'm setting for this.
We'll get to that.
Because none of this shit is coherent. I just want you to understand.
Right. I get that. Well, it's paramilitary action stuff from the 90s. So it's comparable to what was being produced in the time period. It's not worse than, it's not better than. It's
absolutely worse.
The fact that I could read it, I'm the one who actually read it, and it wasn't painful. I've read some painful stuff over the course of this podcast. It wasn't that bad.
There is no good, there is no bad.
So then the group trains for a few months as a unit, and then they deploy at the Pakistan border on April the 26th, 1986, on their way to Kabul, Afghanistan. The Afghan mission is to retrieve downed pilots who had a list of spies that were embedded in the USSR. There's only one surviving pilot who apparently has something to do with NuGene. This is spelled N-U-G-E-N-E. Are you familiar with that term?
No.
NuGene is basically the catch-all term for how metahumans get their powers through genetic engineering, apparently.
So they don't use the word mutant, they use NuGene.
Well, they're not born with mutant powers.
Okay.
As far as I can tell, NuGene is actually genetic alteration to already existing.
So the cap syrup.
Potentially, yeah, because there actually is something that's named almost straight out of Captain America. It's Project Born Again.
Yeah.
And so when we...
I remember reading that.
In the second issue, where they're tracking through Afghanistan, they're being led by a Muslim woman and her child who are fighting against the USSR's occupation in Afghanistan. And at one point, the boy is befriended by either... I can't remember who befriends him.
Are they
him.
Taliban? Or?
They're probably Taliban, yes.
Okay.
So again, this is a Rocky-ish. Riff kind of
thing. Well, flipping through here, there is a Rocky-ish moment where...
Well, they actually do have like the... Well, not Rocky, it's Rambo.
I'm sorry, Rambo.
Because you've got like the dude with the fucking beret, red beret. And he's like the badass Soviet soldier.
And he has the helicopter coming at the soldier, and the soldier's playing a little bit of chicken, and he blows him up with a rocket launcher. And I'm pretty damn sure that's in one of the Rambo movies.
Pretty much, yeah.
The least favorite one, I'm thinking.
Yeah. And so at one point, the little boy that's with the mother has to kill a guy, the first guy he's ever killed, to save his buddy who was on Operation Night Strike. Loss of innocence, yada, yada.
Did you just yada, yada murder? Damn, I wish I had Mac here. He helps me with my joke. He punches up my bits.
In the third issue, they actually make it to Kabul. They make it to the base where the pilot is being kept, fighting Spetsnaz, who are the Russian guys. Who
well, they're also like the badasses of the Russian
military. Right, and they're apparently zombie Spetsnaz. So they've got some kind of broke-ass version of Bloodstrike that they're working with that's tearing shit up, because Operation Night Strike is getting their asses kicked by these dudes by the end of the issue. And then they get captured, and at the very end, we see that the pilot they're trying to save is Cabot, Battlestone's brother. And then what happens in the next issue?
Of what?
There is no next issue. So what happens, I guess they should have stuck with a little two-issue miniseries like they did with Battlestone. The book just stops at the third issue. And there was this motif where they have five bullets. And then on the second issue, one of the bullets has been shot. You just see the smoking shell, and you have like four bullets left. And so the third issue, you have so many bullets left. So it looks like they're counting down on a six-issue miniseries, but only three issues ever come out. Fraley... I thought that at one point that he's tied somehow to Priest. I had no reason to believe that now, because the names are not the same, and I can't find any appearances of Fraley after this aborted miniseries. So we don't know how any of this shit resolves.
He joined KISS.
No, but this was 1986, so he did actually already quit KISS. Again, I had to do this research.
I don't know what to do.
Well, so he quit for a short time, became a mercenary, joined Young Bloods. Left Young Bloods and went back to KISS to tour.
I know Peter Criss has already been fired, and the Fox is in there now. And I had to do a dive. I had to do a dive into KISS. You know, I couldn't help myself.
I just got franked on trivia for KISS.
So one thing we do know, though, is based on the Chapel miniseries and specials, the same year in 86, probably later that year, is when Chapel was supposed to have killed Kustan Hakmed's daughter while blowing up his house, setting up that one-shot story. So then we're, quote-unquote, in 1990. The story involving the Fist of the Bazaar in Virginia, where Battlestone is pretending to be a bad guy to recruit Chapel into Youngblood, or the Young Project anyway. Obviously, that can't happen in 1990. So I think, based on the timeline we've established, that's probably occurring in 86 or 87. Okay?
Okay. Sure, why not?
It's during the Battlestone miniseries that we also see another event from this same time frame around 1986, although the date's never explicitly listed, where Operation Night Strike has a clash with Cybernet. Remember, these are the terrorists from the Extreme Studios universe. Okay. So they have a clash with Cybernet in Philadelphia. Apparently, these guys pretty much run Philly at this point. Operation Night Strike had no idea what they were getting into. They get their asses fucking kicked. There's three hard-headed members that decide they're going to try to take the fight back to Cybernet, even though the rest of the guys are pretty much on the run. Battlestone, Apple, and Dutch, led on a wild goose chase in the subway tunnels of Philly. Which, does Philly have subways? I've been to Philly, but I didn't see any subways while I was there, so I don't know if they have them.
I'm assuming they would. I mean,
maybe East so. Coast. Yeah, because wasn't Blow Up with John Travolta set in Philly? They had subways in Blow Up, didn't they?
The fuck are you talking
about? Brian De Palma movie with Karen Allen. Or not Karen Allen.
John Travolta?
John Travolta, yeah. You've seen Blow Up, right? The one where he plays a Foley artist and he's recording and he hears the gunshot.
Yes.
That's Philly, right?
I don't know. Did they have a fucking movie in the 80s.
Well, it's a great movie, though. It's one of my favorite De Palma movies.
That's debatable, but yeah, no, I haven't seen that one since like the 80s.
It's not debatable. It's one of my favorites.
Okay.
I didn't say it was the best or anything. Chapel finally decides he's going to blow a hole through a wall and jump down the hole and go after Cybernet on his own, apparently, because he thinks the other guys are behind him. But then Dutch shoots Battlestone in the head and kills him. And it turns, and he says right before he does it, Geiger says hello. So Dutch has been turned traitor by Geiger, the guy who runs Cybernet, the cybernetic dude that was trying to kill Chapel in Youngblood Strike File. See how it's all kind of tying together?
Sort
of.
Not really, but sure, why not?
So then we go to 1987, and that's firmly listed in Spawn number one as the year that Al Simmons was murdered. So you can see Operation Night Strike is already deteriorated from April of 1986 through into 1987 when Al Simmons dies. Okay?
Okay.
So then we get to Youngblood Genesis, which was published by Arcade Comics. This was like the third or fourth company that Liefeld was associated with his characters.
And had an actual writer, I think.
We're going to get to that. Liefeld formed his company out in California with Jimmy J of J's Company Comics. And J Company Comics basically was one of those outfits that did the variant covers and did mail order and shit. And so they managed to produce a total of 10 comic books. Only Youngblood Genesis was able to reach a second issue, I think, that was published. Maybe Bloodsport got some sort of ashcan or something. The number one comes out in July of 2003. The book was plotted by Kurt Busiek. So you said a real writer.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting about this is Busiek actually wrote the story in 1994. It was originally going to be a project called Youngblood Year One. And he'd been hired on the strength of Marvels with Alex Ross. Rob Liefeld was supposed to draw it. It ended up never coming to pass. Apparently, Liefeld's schedule was too hectic, so it never got past the plotting phase for Kurt Busiek. Kurt Busiek plotted either two or three issues of Youngblood Year One, which was solicited by Diamond Previews, by the way. And it was going to have a cover by George Perez, which was later repurposed into a pinup page in Youngblood Battlezone. Two or three issues were plotted by Busiek, and then an outline was done for another issue. Nothing else comes of the project for years. Again, this is 94, and the first issue is published in 2003. So what had happened is Liefeld wanted to use the plots that Busiek had conceived, but Busiek, by the time he was ready to actually produce a comic book, was too busy to come back and script the story. So Liefeld kept soliciting Youngblood Genesis as though it were written entirely by Kurt Busiek, and so there was this great deal of acrimony where they went back and forth, where Busiek's like, I only plotted this series, quit trying to solicit it as me as a writer, I did not write the story. And Liefeld's like, well, you know, you came up with a story is writing, therefore you're the writer. And so they were going back and forth. There's a lot of heated words between them on like Usenet and shit to show how far back the shit goes. So finally, Liefeld apologized for misrepresenting or misunderstanding what it meant to be the writer of the comic book. And so he brought in a guy to script it named Brandon Thomas. This was the first comic book he ever did. He had had a background working for Silver Bullet Comics. He wrote a column called Ambidextrous. Now, Silver Bullet Comics was billed as the most diverse comic webzine. It actually gave out, though, in 2007. He went on to write Horizon. Never loaned you my copy of the first Horizon trade?
No.
That's one with the blue aliens and stuff? Mm-mm. I read the first trade. It was solid, but I didn't feel like there was enough there to make me continue to buy the book. But it was a decent book. He also wrote Noble, or is writing currently Noble, for Lion Forge. And he did a bunch of Voltron books for Dynamite. So he's kept working through to the present day, so not too bad of a writer there. But when you're saying, oh, they got a writer for this one, well, they got a plotter,
because the story actually made sense.
But the script was good too, though.
Yeah. Let's be honest. This is the first time where the characters are introduced, and I didn't have to wait three or four issues to understand their origins or anything. Like, that was the running gag with Layfield's books, is it's like you walked in the middle of a story and you missed the first four issues, but it's issue one. I don't understand. This one, I mean, I love the fact that they give the origins of the aliens crashing and, you know, how they, you know.
Well, I mean, we're about to talk about the plot of the story, so maybe we'll touch on that. What do you think about the artwork?
That's solid.
So the art was provided by Chad and Eric Walker. This was their only major work in comics. They're from Dallas. The twin brothers with a background in video games. They actually still are active with a company called Walker Boy Studio that does artwork and work for video games and stuff. Big time Christian guys too. Like, their site engine is Christian. They have Bible quotes and stuff like that. I like the art, but it's weird because it's not very Extreme Studios. Did you notice how strong of a Will Portacio influence there was on the artwork?
A little bit.
There's a little bit of Sam Keith in there.
Well, the shading, I guess I could see that.
Little Tom Coker, of all people, who did Vanguard and some other Eisenstein stuff, more kind of an esoteric artist. So just a weird choice for artwork on a Youngblood book, but I liked it fairly well. And then on the first issue, the finishes were by Rob Liefeld. I think the second issue, it was Liefeld and Dan Fraga.
So we're pretty much introduced to the team of Youngbloods, but this one was a little different because they're really focusing on, what's his name, Graves,
who's bringing the team together.
Yeah, he's sort of like he's not really the narrator, but he's the focal character and the through line throughout the miniseries.
He had a team called, what was it, Night Strike.
Yeah.
And they get caught on video executing some Guatemalan drug dealers. Al Simmons is there. Chapel is there. Chapel's actually saying, God bless America, as they're gunning them down. And it's about to be released.
They got a close-up of Cabot, Battlestone's brother, who was on the team.
Yeah.
And Battlestone, I think, himself was on the team. But I don't think any of the other guys that we've seen in the miniseries or the flashbacks were in there. So no Dutch, no Fraley, none of that bullshit.
No Cougar or any of these guys.
Cougars, well, no, this isn't Youngbloods. This is Operation Ice Strike.
Yeah, I know. I'm saying none of those guys have been introduced yet.
Right.
We just have this basic hit squad.
We have the Night Strike.
Yeah. And they're about to be exposed. We'll put Graves in danger of losing his job because the president...
I probably should have made this clear earlier. Graves is some muckety-muck in the government, part of the military-industrial complex.
See?
And he, in some ways...
Okay, was this stuff going on at the same time as, like, I.O. with John Lynch and all that shit?
Presumably, yeah.
Okay, so... because
all these dark military-industrial complex bullshit going on.
Yeah, you got, like, these, you know... little generals with their little armies making these counter moves.
Which IO is Wildstorm. That's what one secret clandestine government operation with agents
but
and shit.
But aren't they all in the same universe?
Well, they're part of the Image universe. Yeah. But
They don't interact with each other.
IO, so far, we've not seen IO, and I guess this would be CI, which is sort of like the CIA interacting so far.
Yeah. He's in danger of being ousted, exposed.
Well, part of it, too, is that he's a really master manipulator, but he tried to delegate the damage control and the Night Strike revelation to other people, and apparently fucked up, and so he was basically getting his goose cooked. So he had to start focusing on saving his ass and how he was going to go about that.
But at the time, then they find his alien spacecraft has crashed, and there's two occupants in there, and they're downstairs, and he's kind of focused on it because he realizes now he can use this as leverage.
Yeah, I'll point out too that we initially see the UFO flying over Boston, and it seemed like he's going to landfall there, but then they say it was actually 25 miles outside of DC, so a little vague where that happened.
That scene where Al Simmons and was it Battlestone shoot? Looks like Jules and Vincent. The spaceship crashes. He talks about how the alien is learning our language really quick.
He learned the rudimentary English in 2 days.
Yeah.
And that's only combat, Catellan. Because there's also an Arcturian.
Photon.
Who's the guy who looks like, Photon. And he's the dude with all the energy powers. And he doesn't speak at all. He doesn't speak a lick of any language.
Does he go by combat?
It's phonetically combat. It's like Lieutenant Kumbat or something. Yeah. With a K.
Kumbate. Kumbate.
Lack of vowels and an apostrophe and all that kind of bullshit.
He decides that he's formulating his idea where he's going to create a super team.
There's one little quote that I'd like to.
I got to ask you this question though, real quick.
Go ahead.
While this book is being written, is X-Force as well coming out? The Peter Milligan X-Force? Because it's very similar.
Here's the thing. Number one, the book was plotted in 94.
Okay.
So that was before the Milligan Allred X-Force run, which later became X-Statics.
Yeah.
Okay. The book is actually coming out in 2003, which is after Milligan and Allred. I've always felt that X-Force was a lot like what Youngblood should have been, and they never had the writers to get there.
Yeah.
But I think that's what they'd always had in mind.
Their intention.
And I feel like maybe Youngblood might have inspired the creation of X-Force. But by the same token, the idea of these media-savvy superheroes, that was something that would be naturally occurring anyway. At some point, you'd have to
address
that.
I really loved X-Force and X-Static. I thought the characters were well-written, the stories were great. That's one of my favorite books.
Milligan would have been a great guy to do Youngblood because he basically did a lot of what Youngblood should have been in X-Force.
Yeah. Okay, I'm just wondering because, like I said, it had the same very feel to it.
Yeah, and again, that's what Youngblood was promoted as being. It just very rarely got to that place. It never quite got that cynicism. It never got into the dark side of the media. Really, it was mostly fight. So the premise was sound, but the execution, it didn't get to where it said it was supposed to be, and Milligan did.
Now Graves knows that he has two aliens. He's formulating to create a... They're brainstorming. I like that part, too, where they're brainstorming to try to come up with, what are we going to do with these guys? We got to create something. Because,
well, more like that. It's more like Graves is trying to figure out how he's going to get out of hot water over Night Strike. Plus, he's got these aliens lying around. So it's not that he's trying to figure out what to do with the aliens. He's just trying to figure out what to do.
Well, no, because he knows the aliens will be a distraction. He's like, come on, dude, there's aliens. Like, we have proof that there's life off the planet.
The aliens do set him off because they send teams to check out the ship. Among the people who goes in there is Graves himself to go check it out. And he says, upon stepping into that ship, the scale upon which humankind operates became unbalanced. Our limitations as a species fundamentally erased. The presence of these aliens, who demonstrate, I guess, pretty rapidly powers that we do not have, available to us, showed Graves that humanity was about to take an evolutionary leap. And he wasn't concerned about shit like Night Strike anymore. He was concerned about how we're going to soup up the human race. For no other reason, because you see the potential based on these aliens, but also the recognition that if these aliens are running around, you're going to need to soup up the human race.
That's the thing I kind of like. Well, I don't want to jump too much ahead because this was, correct me if I'm wrong, the plotter, is he creating, is he doing a world building here, or yes. is this the writer?
Yes.
The writer the plot, is dialogue?
All of this is in the plot, most okay. probably.
Because
but the plot's going to be like, Graves overhears a conversation between the two men about some toys featuring the Allies, and recognizing that the potential superhero decides that he's going to create a superhero team. And then a guy like Brandon Thomas is going to go in there and actually write the dialogue about okay. how that... The, like the
because the plotting was fantastic. I love the fact that you're using the aliens, and then they're hinting that there's creatures out there now. Mm-hmm. Some cat-like creature that he hopes has breasts, because they need a female on the team.
Right.
And I just thought that was great. I'm like, oh, cool. They don't ever show you. Well, they actually, only simply allude to it.
Yeah, I actually want to show you something. I made a point. We were at a comic shop the other day where they had dollar boxes, and I found a comic in those dollar boxes that I've wanted to have a copy of for a while. And what kills me, I hate paying a dollar for it, because I swear these books haunted the 20-cent bin. I had five $4 bins back in my comic shop days, and I could have just kept the goddamn book. But anyway, this is Entity Comics number 1, 1994, cover 8, Megaton Holiday Special. There's actually a note on the inside from Rob Liefeld saying, "To Gary, what can I say? You believed in me first and strongest. I owe a lot of it to you. Welcome back to the comics business. Best, Rob Liefeld." And so Gary Carlson is the guy who did the Megaton comics that were around in the mid-80s. So he's the guy who discovered Liefeld. He discovered Eric Larson. He discovered Angel Medina. And he published a lot of their early work. And if you look on the back, a lot of those characters that they created, like Megaton and Berserker and Vanguard, Ultra Girl or Ulta Girl, I'm not sure, they're all in the background with an X-Men style logo saying X-Men is coming. And what looks like a young Peter David as Santa Claus riding a sleigh. I'm pretty sure that's actually supposed to be Gary Carlson. So what I want you to do is look at the very centerfold of that book. It's on a glossier stock, so it's easy to spot. It's like a cover stock in the middle, or like a poster stock, like what Wizard used to have in their magazine in the early days.
This one?
A Tigra type character at the very top.
Well, overall, what do you see?
Youngblood.
Drawn by Rob Liefeld in his early days, around 1987 or so, inked by Jerry Ordway, and showing the entire Extreme Universe to come in an earlier version.
So you have a Tigra type character, you have a Magnus villain looking character, mm-hmm. you have a character who is pretty much wearing Colossus's costume with the armor and the red and the...
That's Sentinel, right?
Yeah, Sentinel basically looks like Colossus, minus the head.
But the point being is all these early Youngblood characters are there, and including is that Cat Lady. And my understanding is that Liefeld had a role to play in the creation of the Panther character from the New Titans. And of course, he created Feral and Thorn in X-Force. So this dude's been wanting to do a cat-type character along the lines of Mademoiselle Hepzibah or Tigra since his earliest days in doing comics. And yet, that Catwoman has never seemed to appear in any of his fucking comic books, aside from that two-page spread, it seems like.
Cool.
But you can see that Kurt Busiek was plotting that and trying to get all those Easter eggs in there. It's nice that he even went back to these unpublished Megaton materials and this
centerfold. And find these characters. They allude to, can I already jump to Cougar and all them? Or
one thing I want to point out too is we do have reference, one of the people who's helping to put together Operation Night Strike and apparently maybe involved with Youngblood as well is a fellow named Jacob Wind, W-Y-N-N-D. Who was concerned about the news reporting on Operation Night Strike. This is clearly Jason Wynn. And this is after the fallout between Liefeld and Image. So you can see where he fucked with the name a little bit to kind of cover up for that, since the story was written back when they were all part of the same universe.
Oh, got you.
So
nice. So link to Spawn.
And the thing is, too, is you mentioned that Al is in this story.
Yeah.
He's never called Al Simmons, only Al.
Al, yeah, I know. Yeah,
so clever. One other thing, too, that plays a key part in Youngblood is that the two aliens are jailed under the Pentagon, where Youngblood has its secret base. And they never reveal, of those two life forms, one is supposed to be the captor and one is supposed to be the prisoner. And Combat refuses to tell which one was which. But he also points out that the world is going to come to an end soon, so it doesn't really matter anyway, setting up something to happen in the future. Another thing we need to talk about is that one of the people they really want for Youngblood is an FBI cadet named Jeffrey Allen Terrell. He was actually a Night Strike project, and then later on they wanted him for Youngblood, but he kept resisting, and that's going to be important later on. We also get reference to Marcus Langston, who was working with his wife on an Exo suit. After funding is pulled for the suit, he rewires it so that it will only work for himself, and that's how we end up with Sentinel, because the Youngblood team is needing to be put together very quickly to save Graves' job, and so Sentinel's available with his Exo suit. Graves sees the potential and gets him in there. Mention is made that Glory, Super Patriot, and Mighty Man are not available, and that nobody's seen Supreme or Roman for years. They've both been missing, which of course plays into the Supreme ongoing series. Grave bluffs the level of power he still has and manages to reactivate something called the Die Hard Project, which leads to the Die Hard Android. He does make a request to have Nicola, Nikki, Yoganova onto the team, but is told she's not ready. She will eventually become Vogue. You talked about the cat creature in Maryland. So what were you wanting to jump to?
Well, I like how they introduced Cougar
and how, you know, it's
yeah, too soon. Okay, so one sec. Night Strike is officially shut down, but Graves pegs Battlestone and Chapel for the new team. It seems likely that a fellow named Resnick, who is an adversarial presence to Graves in the White House, was the one who leaked the video to try to get Graves' job. We also have mentioned in the very early part of the book that the Four are already active. Do you remember the Four?
Yeah, it was like a gang, wasn't it?
They were like a terrorist organization that appeared in the first issue of Youngblood. At this point, the team is made up of Deadlock, the dude who sort of looks like Wolverine, Gage, the military dude with the red face, Starbright, the chick in the gold armor, and Strongarm, the big dude with the... Did he have multiple arms, or he's just a big guy?
I had multiple arms. I don't remember.
The four of them were all in Youngblood number one, so it's kind of nice that they noted that the four were active before Youngblood even existed.
But they're kind of the catalyst, right, to start the push for creating a superhero team.
Yeah, I think it's very likely that Graves set that up, right? They really nudge, wink, wink.
False flag, right? Probably. Yeah.
So there's a note made that no government-affiliated superhero strike force to counter a group like the Ford existed since the Liberty League disbanded years ago. Are you familiar with the Liberty League?
No.
Me neither. I had to look them up. So these guys were apparently created for Savage Dragon number 47, and it was Larson's version of the Allies or the Invaders or the Justice Society, however you want to put it. That team is Mighty Man, Hornet, who's basically a Wasp ripoff, Mr. Big, who's a giant man ripoff, Super Patriot, who I guess is doing double duty, and a guy named Rex Dexter, who is like an android robot dude, I guess. And of course, like you said, it may be a false flag kind of situation, but Director Graves insists to Assistant Director Kiever that it was just a coincidence they were building a super team just when the president would need one. Graves mentions that the team is still much too ugly for the long term, but he basically is going with the team he has, not the team that he wants to have, you know, kind of a Rumsfeld situation.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, at the end of the issue, we see Graves took the name for the team from the Youngbloods, who were playing on an oldies radio station. Presumably, they were playing the song Get Together, because that was their one hit. Do you know that song?
No. Go ahead and sing it. One, two, three, go.
I'm trying to remember. Hold on.
Get together right now.
You're just fucking me up, so never mind.
No. Did you just get stage fright?
No, I can't remember the fucking song because you started racing and Come Together. Now that's stuck in my brain. I was already struggling.
Hold on. Let's find on YouTube. I want to see what it sounds like. What's the name of the song?
Get Together by the Youngbloods.
Get Together.
I'm actually kind of curious now.
You know it. Come on, people now. Smile on your brother. Everybody get together. Try to love one another right now. If you've ever seen Pump with the Volume, that's a song that Christian Slater's character makes fun of. Happy Harry Hard On.
Oh, yeah. It's a Vietnam song. Now, baby. Back in 67. The day.
God damn, this is a Vietnam song. Can't we get our own music? Jarhead. Yeah. This is
No, but it's the end though, on that one. That's when they're playing This Is the End.
That's what I'm saying though. Youngblood is a Iraq War era team, so true. They'd be kind of pissed off to get this Vietnam music. Don't we get our own music?
But that is kind of cool that they use this song to name Youngblood. Come on, dude. That's...
Well, I'm wondering if that's true or if it's just Buzik.
Fucking clever. That's fucking clever.
The custodian is washing up.
But you have a fucking hippie song to a fucking, like...
Fairly violent super team, yeah.
Well, not just that. It's just a glammed out fucking... What would you say? They're almost like a influencer glam superhero team.
Right. Insubstantial, superficial.
Yeah. That is so cool, man. That's...
Shallow.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, very shallow. But that just made this book so much cooler now. In my mind, anyway. Cool. Okay, so that's the end of issue one.
Probably ought to look at summer of 1988 with the Youngblood number zero. What happens in that book?
Oh, God, I don't know. Dude, you made me read it, and I've already forgotten.
You've already forgotten what happened?
Yeah, it was not very good. I know you said it wasn't that bad. I didn't like it at all.
Okay, so Youngblood number zero was by Rob Liefeld, Dan Fraga, and Danny Meekie. It was released on December the 11th, 1992, as a stopgap between Youngblood issue number three, which had come out 2 months earlier, and issue number four, which would come out 2.5 months later. Incongruously, based on what happens in Youngblood Genesis, there's already supposed to be multiple Youngblood teams. Colonel Stones is seen as the newest and least polished, but only option for the mission that's needed. So George H.W. Bush orders that team to go to Iraq to prevent the invasion of Kuwait, even though that's not going to happen for 2 years. Supposedly, the invasion is led by Hussein, which is a reference to the Hassan Hussein bullshit analog from Youngblood number one. So I think they forgot to take out some names or change some names. So the lineup in Youngblood number zero includes Riptide, who chick with white hair and a blue outfit who controls water. Chapel, and Die Hard. The president insists on having normal troops joining Youngblood on missions to keep up morale for the normal troops and to keep them engaged. Graves is against that because he feels like they're inadequate for these type of missions now. Colonel Boggs is one of those normal troops, and he defies a direct order from Battlestone and checks out an underground tunnel network with a volunteer named Rains. Boggs complains that he should be leading before triggering a booby trap that kills both of them in an explosion. There's a third guy named Gamble who accuses Battlestone of not stopping Boggs because he questioned orders, so Battlestone punches him. It only takes one punch for Battlestone to break Gamble's neck, and he instantly dies. Die Hard then flips out and beats Battlestone's ass. Chapel demands and receives Battlestone's surrender, and he's arrested. Colonel John Helix Stone, they fucked up his name in this one appearance, is sentenced by a secret tribunal just 59 hours later. In light of past service and the need to keep this quiet in an election year, Stone is discharged from the military in Youngblood rather than court-martialed and imprisoned. But Battlestone does vow to take out all the political sewage that's ruining America, including the secret tribunal. However, in the Youngblood Genesis book, what happens is that footage was shot of the altercation, which was set to air on CNN. So Grave goes with court-martialing Battlestone. Night Strike's records are leaked, and rumors of Battlestone was planning to assassinate the whole team are also leaked. Sentinel overheard that plan and threatened to go public, but was told that if he did, he'd be in a cell right next to Battlestone. A few days later, Sentinel was held back from a major mission, but a digitally created fake was inserted into the footage, and it was broadcast live. So they had some pretty advanced technology in 1988, it would have been. So the Youngblood team barely wins a hard-fought victory against the Cape supervillain named Quantum, who had murdered 36 people on national television.
Which I thought was kind of a plant by Graves, because he kind of shows up out of nowhere. Almost kind of, I don't know, it just seemed really strange. Like, he shows up.
Like they're using that to cover up the Battlestone situation. Yeah. One wonders, yeah.
And just real quick, side note, that cool two-page spread in the middle where Battlestone's in cuffs.
This is in the Youngblood number 0.
Yeah, 0. Yeah, I totally swiped that for an art project in high school because I had to come up with something fast and I had been partying all weekend. And we had a project due on a Monday, and I think by Sunday, 10 o'clock, couldn't come up with that. I think I had that issue just open. Took that image, put the colors I needed to, and turned it in, and I got a decent grade for it.
So we both have swiped Rob Liefeld in our past.
Yeah. Thanks, Rob.
And well, you were funny too, because you were like, I'm being confronted with my past sins, because you had no recollection of that.
Not until you made me, I opened that page and I was like, this is where, because I remember thinking, did I maybe come up with that image? Because I was like, it was pretty good image. I just couldn't, I literally had to come up with a quick image, had no thought into it, had to be a character, and took that, changed, I guess it changed the color schemes, a little,
So was he a character of your own in that instance?
No, it was a project we were doing, like painting, and so I was part of the group that did the set designs, and we were doing some play, and they wanted like citizens in the back, like it was supposed to be like a prison, so we were supposed to come up with bars and stuff, so I basically just drew this image on a giant piece of wood like he's a prisoner in the background, but we just shadowed a lot of stuff around him, so it looks like he was kind of in the foreground.
You could charge like $500 for that at Comic Palooza now.
Probably, but at that time I remember people were like, man, that's great, it's a great concept for the prison scene. I'm like, yeah.
So what we see too in that battle with Quantum is that you, besides Sentinel, you've got all the members that are available. It's an all hands on deck sort of situation, including new members Bad Rock, Cougar, and Vogue, plus an assist from the new men, which we haven't touched on yet, and we probably won't in the near future. But I think those are sort of like X-Men New Mutiny type characters. I don't know.
The big Sasquatch.
Yeah, and Kodiak, I believe his name
Kodiak
was.
Kodiak, yeah.
So it took fucking everybody to deal with this dude. By the way, you remember when Bad Rock was brought in as a candidate for Youngblood, how Graves reacted?
Well, I know he walks up and he wanted to be a toy, and then Bad Rock was talking about how he wants to be called Bedrock, and he's like, oh, we'll see about it. You talking about that scene?
Yeah, and also Graves just thinks he's perfect because I don't know if it's because he's toyetic or because he looks like a superhero.
Well, I think Graves had an idea of the team he wanted to build. It had to have a certain a look. He had a vision of what he wanted his superhero team to look like. And I guess you want your Thing, your Miss Marvel. I mean, you got these characters you need. Because remember, he needed a female. Really needed a female. They couldn't get Vogue in. The Catwoman wasn't in there. They bring in Riptide. And they're talking about how, like, oh, we'll have another female real soon. Though I do like that they gave Riptide a really cool origin story.
Yeah, go into that some.
So apparently, she's sitting there and they ask her. She's on some kind of nightly, like, talk show. And they ask her how she got her powers. And she talks about how she was almost drowning. And then I guess she just developed them while she was underwater. Is that what she's kind of bullshitting at, right?
Yeah, that she'd been hired by Gator International because she was a marine biologist to check on some phenomenon.
Yeah.
And she got knocked out and she woke up and she had the powers. But it turns out
there's a woman. I assume
she's, like, she's a witch. I think the witch of the green.
Well, I was thinking like, you know, Swamp Thing, you know, since he's part of the green, like some kind of, you know, what do they call them? Elementals?
Yeah.
So I figured she was some kind of elemental that gave her the power of water. And Graves is a little obsessed with catching the witch. He wants to catch her so he can create more. And then, we get introduced to Cougar, who apparently mother had sex with a cat-like creature,
mm-hmm.
which created him.
Yeah, and Graves wanted that guy too, but can't find him.
Because he wants to start producing cat people. He can't have another race runner. And it's just really interesting where these characters, like I said, are starting to come out. You're world building with these characters.
Oh, by the way, who's on the talk show with Riptide? Because I jumped around on my notes by mistake and I missed.
The Jason Wynn character? Or?
No, the Link.
Oh, the psychic, right?
Well, he's not a psychic. He's just named Link. It's a dude with dark hair who wears like a brown uniform, and he's a telepath with telekinetic abilities. He's real quiet and shy, so Riptide does most of the talking.
Is he the one that in the Hussein books goes ape shit?
No, that's Sci-Fire.
Oh, Sci-Fire. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Link has not been seen very often. Link was shown in Youngblood number 0 at the very end when they're showing the then current team, and Buzik gets use out of him in this talk show sequence, but his affiliation with Youngblood seems to be very limited, okay. So he's a little bit mysterious what happened to this dude.
Graves is obsessed with wants to create more superhero characters, because that seems to be a little bit of the obsession is creating newer heroes.
They also show the first mission that Riptide and Link participate in when they were combating Cybernet, which again the media wasn't familiar with, so this was like sort of their debut, the populace knowing who Cybernet is. They're attacking the Washington Monument. The media confuses Cybernet with Cyberforce, so apparently Cyberforce is already a thing at that point too, at least in the media circles. So this is going on at the Washington Monument, and the Cybernet terrorists are led by a guy who looks suspiciously like Dutch. So I'm wondering if that was supposed to be Dutch, or if Dutch just modeled his later Youngblood uniform after some of these guys that worked at Cybernet. I'm not sure what the plan was with that. Do you want to tell them a little bit about the Blood Pool?
So I guess it's almost like their minor league team, where they kind of have these a pool of characters that are still working out the bugs, trying, you know, I guess mastering their powers. So yeah, it's almost like their AAA team or AAA league, where they're kind of just farming these characters so they can move up, because they're kind of hinting that there's going to be two teams now.
Mm-hmm.
And so it again, world building. I'm down. Yeah. I'm really enjoying the books so far. It's the first Youngblood book I can think of that wasn't just like, yeah, I'm done. Like, yeah. I don't want to finish reading this. So
when you're talking about too, the trainees that are being cycled through Blood Pool include Vogue, Brahma, Lethal, and some other guys that I didn't recognize. Cougar has been in the Blood Pool, but he's already graduating into having his own like little sub team of Blood Pool.
And then of course
recruits.
Graves is trying to manipulate him by saying, give him some responsibility, let him feel like he feels trusted.
And you see he's already planning on getting rid of Battlestone and Chapel, and then all of a sudden this event happens with Battlestone that makes him look bad and gets him discharged. So you have to wonder if Graves was manipulating that to happen.
I'm telling
too.
You, I believe
my understanding too is that a lot of those humans were apparently clones too, so he didn't actually kill. Now that doesn't excuse Battlestone from helping getting these beings killed. So he didn't.
Well,
no,
they were real soldiers. Remember, because they talk about how the president didn't want the military to feel
right. They said that, but then in the Youngblood number 0, they note that at least two of the guys were actually clones that they could just make them over again. So it's possible that that was a setup of Graves's.
And the thing is, by what I've seen so far, it's very Tao-like. I could absolutely see him do that.
You're talking about Dao from Wildcats.
Yeah,
I just want to clarify.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm jumping around a little bit. Because he manipulates characters from a distance.
Oh, it's also worth noting that Graves was planning to create a fake hostage situation to help introduce Vogue to the public. And that he and assistant director Kiever, who is the guy that the public thinks Youngblood reports to because Graves is trying to keep himself out of the spotlight, they're planning to use money and prestige to woo Jeff Terrell away from the FBI. But they have to get rid of his father out of the picture. His father's apparently Colonel Bravo, who's going to turn up in later Youngblood comics. He's basically Cable. Okay. It was Liefeld trying to steal Cable back, get him out of Washington so he stops influencing Terrell to stay away from Youngblood.
So, okay.
And now, so that's basically the issue there.
Okay, so explain to me why we didn't get a third issue.
That's a good question. Once again, the book just stops coming out. It's never finished. And what's a shame is we know that 3 to 4 issues were plotted, so we know that there's still more material to potentially be produced. The Walkers would still be available if you wanted to get their artwork in there again. Brandon Thomas is still working at Image, so he would be potentially available. Do it as an original graphic novel. Finish this fucking story. This is one of the best Youngblood stories either one of us have ever read, if not the best.
I can think of three.
But just like Operation Nightstrike, this is, seems like it's telling a story that would be foundational for Extreme Studios at the least, and potentially the entirety of Image Comics as a shared universe. And that actually may be part of the problem too, is that there's still acrimony among the Image founders, and Liefeld's no longer a partner, and he may not want to go hat in hand and talk to some of these people. I don't know that he would have access to anything resembling Spawn anymore. I don't know what the relationship is between Liefeld and McFarlane at this point. Some of it may be money. You know, Will Portacio talked about in, I don't know if it made it into the episode or not, but he was talking about how, you know, it used to be they would all work together and try to produce comics as part of the shared universe, but the money gets in the way, and why do you want to get 75% of the money or 50% of the money when you can have 100% of the money? So it may just be that you can't get the characters to get together and, you know, the creators to work together to get these books out. But there's no reason why Liefeld could neither use analogs or do the vague references like we were doing and finish a fucking book.
Well, because I was thinking, like, you got Bloodsport by Mark Millar, which would sell off the fucking shelf.
Still, today would be a great seller.
Yeah, and it's only two issues. You have the Alan Moore, which was only one issue, which had a great fucking build up, a great artwork, and you had fucking 12 different variant covers of that one, and they never fucking finished it. I mean, there's three Youngblood books I would like to finish, and they never fucking finish them.
And one thing worth noting too is that this book, Genesis, there was like an 8-month gap in between issues. And jeez, what should have been at least a 4-issue miniseries, two issues came out 15 years ago.
Jeez.
So, and I understand that, I seem to recall there were complaints about non-payment at that time period from a variety of Liefeld's companies. So I'm not sure if people just, the checks didn't clear, and so these things just stop. I'm not sure if the shakeup at Image that saw Liefeld pushed out of the company or quitting the company, depending on who you talk to, I don't know how that impacted these books' production. But in particular, Youngblood Genesis would be a great book to have reintroduced Youngblood, and that didn't happen. So
almost like he just goes to the next scheme.
I'm going to put a great big asterisk under scheme. Let's not use the term scheme.
No, it does. It is like he gets you hyped up over this great writer and great art for the story that seems going to be cool, and then it just peters out.
Yeah, what I would say is that Liefeld has a great deal of enthusiasm, but not necessarily a great attention span. And he would dispute that because he often gets very irate when he points out, well, I got 6 issues of Hawk and Dove out, and I got so many issues of this out. But put out fucking Youngblood Genesis then.
The bar's pretty low. Don't fucking pat yourself on the back when the fucking bar. 6 issues of fucking Hawk and Dove?
Well, these days, doing 6 issues is
good. You're patting yourself on the back for the wrong win there, bud.
So, but we would love to see this book get finished, right? It'd be good to see this book get finished, right?
I mean, it's going to fall to the back if I don't give a fuck real soon. So, if he had come up with the books, if the books were out now, I would go look for them. And I'd be like, oh, yeah, I want to finish this story. But because it's been so long, it's slowly falling back to the I don't give a fuck, so I'm going to move on because there's so much more to read.
Yeah,
I could care less. And so his scheme failed.
I'm going to, again, object to the term scheme, the use of the word scheme.
I don't know, man. Seems like a cash grab.
But given that
he was fighting to put Buziak's name on it. He knew that would draw. Dude, when I saw Buziak, I'm not a huge Buziak fan.
Yeah.
By the stretch of the imagination. I like some of his Astro City stuff, but I'm not a huge, like, oh, I got to buy his book. But I saw it on a Youngblood book. This was the first time I'm like, okay, I'll read this because everything else you gave me,
the world building is really interesting.
Yeah. I was like, when I read the first issue, I would have definitely paid for a second issue.
Yeah.
Cash grab.
Yeah. And I just enjoy seeing an Image Comics universe. I miss that, and I wish that somebody besides Robert Kirkman seemed to have any desire to have there still be an Image Comics universe, because you can see the effort being put
into building. That would be kind of cool to see Youngbloods running through fucking The Walking Dead.
Not The Walking Dead.
Yes, absolutely. No. That's how you end The Walking Dead, dude. The Image universe is just running around the whole time. Just fucking shit all over the book and all those characters. He's not making money off of that shit anymore.
What do you mean?
Kirkman?
He's not making money off of it. What are you talking about?
Well, I heard the books don't sell as great as they used to.
Maybe not, but it's not like he's not maybe making peak money, but he's still making money off of it. It's still feeding storylines in the TV show that he's still making money off of. So the TV show isn't getting the ratings that it used to, but it's not like it's not worth doing or anything.
Well, then, you know what would have been great? If he had the Youngbloods run through the Invincible book.
I think he did. I don't know how much Youngblood, because a lot of the time that Invincible was being produced, Rob Liefeld was persona non grata to Image.
Yeah.
But certainly the other Image characters did. And again, just Kirkman was the one guy.
Wolfman showed up. No, there's no Spawn.
Yeah, there's Spawn. No,
when did Spawn show up in fucking Invincible?
I think it was issue either 50 or 100, because they had that one issue or that few issues where like everybody showed up. Where Savage Dragon was in there, Witchblade was in there. Because I remember, because I was like one of the only issues.
Was it just a pinup?
No. I mean, they did a wraparound cover, but they were also part of these big battles that were taking place inside the book.
I'm going to look for it. I'm gonna look for it.
I think it was, Invincible 50 that happened. Okay. So
I'll look it up.
Yeah, again, you know, I listen to the episode, so I can. I think I usually see this feedback anyway, so I'm familiar.
I'm a legal machine.
What happened was I was still figuring out how to do the show. Initially, it was going to be, you know, we were going to do like and a Youngblood episode and a Wildcats episode. And because we were talking so much about the creators, that kind of came to the fore. And so that kind of pushed things back. But, you know, Spawn is sort of an old little island. So to a large degree, it didn't matter in the early days. But then I realized there's a bunch of stuff that's going to happen with Chapel, especially and how he relates to Spawn that ties into a bunch of other books. And suddenly I realized, oh, crap, all this stuff's going to tie into Spawn eventually. I've got to start laying the groundwork now before we get messed up. So for up through at least episode 30 or so, it's going to be more heavy Extreme Studios and Shadowline, and I have to push like Wildstorm stuff to the back burner. So suddenly it's like we have a firm schedule where before we were kind of, you know, being all bohemian and chill and like, yeah, we'll do what we're going to do, you know, that kind of thing. So probably we'll burn through that, and then we'll probably have more guests, because I already talked to Ryan Daly about Wetworks, because I didn't force Mr. Fixit to read 60 issues of Wetworks, although I do think I'm going to encourage him to read some so I can get a little bit more of his opinions, plug that in. But
wait. Did you say 60?
60 issues, yeah.
Wetworks went 60 issues.
Well, see, what happened is they did like 40-odd issues of the first series, and then DC did a revival that ran another 15 issues or so, and Portacio came back and did the first 4 to 6 issues of that one. So I decided I might as well just go ahead and read that whole thing and I was going to do it in one podcast episode, birth this thing, but it was too much me talking. There wasn't enough to fix it. I knew it was going to be terrible, so I went to Ryan Daly, who had more recollection kind of Wetworks. And so I've got a fair amount of material with him and a bunch of material like semi-solo with Fix It. But I don't know if that's going to turn into one episode or two episodes. I know it's going to be an editing nightmare. And because Wetworks isn't relevant to anything we're doing right now, it's kind of been pushed on the back burner. Like the episode you guys like so much, the Wolf Potasio Spotlight, even though that fits with what we've been doing with Creator Spotlight, it wasn't my intention. It's just that I had so much material with Potasio and then so much stuff that was going to be difficult to resolve about the Wetworks series. It was just easier to focus on Potasio. But his story isn't finished too. There's a little bit of a cliffhanger, and there's some stuff about him I did not know that happens going into the 2000s, so I'm really kind of hot to address that too. So I'm not sure when the Wetworks episode is going to happen, but because the episode that's on today, the one that folks just listened to, is so heavily me again because I was doing an information dump, I don't want to have two like that close together, so I'm going to kind of push them away from each other more.
If you say so.
The next episode or two, I'm going to try to make sure that Fix It has more oxygen. But it's funny because I'm playing that, and then he totally fucking stands me up when it comes to the listener feedback.
Sounds like fun.
So we got Tumblr likes from Zegas, which means Michelle Fife. And since I went back and I looked at the Tumblr, that's sort of organic how those get comment, has a long tail. Michelle Fife liked episodes 5 through 7 and 9 through 11 on our Tumblr. Berserker 200 liked Spawn number 7 and Brigade. Rebellion's Angel liked Spawn number 8's Gallery. The Myth liked Spawn number 9 and Angela. And Sweetie Photo liked Spawn number 12 and Cyberforce 10 Men of War. On Twitter, we got a piece of artwork from Storm Chaser, aka Cupid Cable, and it's a Rob Liefeld image with Die Hard and Cougar, I think it was, and Photon. He wrote, "I'm playing fast catch up with Spawnometer and I'm loving it. These books didn't resonate with me when they were originally on the shelves, but I have mad respect for contribution of Image founders, especially Robert Liefeld." Michelle Fife wrote, "Just listen to this in-depth episode about one of my favorites, Will Sportacio, over at the Roll Spine podcast, cameo by Scott Williams." Jeffrey Brown wrote, "Oh, and one more thing I like about Wilson's Image Comics work is this house ad by Wilson Todd on Inks. I think this was in an issue of Spawn." Did you happen to see that when that got posted?
I think so, but it's not ringing.
It's a picture of, I think, Pilgrim or Mother One, one of the female members inked by Todd. And you have to really look to even tell. It still looks pretty much like Will Sportacio, but it looks a little toddy.
Okay, yeah, that sounds like an interesting combo. I would like to see it.
We'll put it up on the blog so it's easier for folks to check out.
No, all right.
Odell Abner Dracula wrote, tangentially related, he's quoting Rob Liefeld saying, "I said, look, back in 1991, I was jamming with two guys, Jim Lee on X-Men and Will Sportacio on Uncanny X-Men. We were the three engines running that office in the early 90s when all the launches happened." And he was talking about that new book he's doing. Did you see anything on that?
This is Robert
Liefeld.
No, I did not see that either. He's got, now I feel like an asshole.
It's some dude and he's got armor and he's got like a...
Oh, with the X on his face?
Yeah, I don't know a lot of the details about that. I think he's like coming from a future where it's a utopian future for mutants, but it's being destroyed. So he comes to our timeline, I think, to try to save his. And I don't care about X-Men anymore. I can't. Rob Liefeld going back can't make me care about X-Men anymore. I don't have it in me anymore.
Yeah, good for him, though, because DC seemed to kind of fuck him over with the New 52 stuff. So
yeah,
I'm glad he's still got at least one major player home.
So Odell Abner Dracula also did an original piece of artwork for us, noting, P.S. Sorry for the inadvertent snub. Fix it. And that was that shot of one of the members of Wetworks beating up a vampire.
Yeah, that was awesome. Odell Abner Dracula can draw good.
And of course, the funny thing is, again, here he is making amends with Mr. Fix-It, who
and he is not even doing the fucking listener commentary feedback. That's so hilarious.
As far as the general social media stuff, we got 108 Sage, Adam Black Moon, Dr. Ann, Anthony Joseph, the Sleepless Metal Monk, Anti-Ashy Afrofuturist Alia, Biko Django, Caroline Wells, Cash Flag, Charlton Hero, Chris at Bad Books for Beginners, Last 1000, a Marvel Superheroes Live RPG, Clinton Robinson of Coffee and Comics podcast and blog, Council of Geeks, aka Nathaniel Wayne, who just recently put up a video for 90s Comics Retrial again, so he's doing that as a video series now. DeBeige, Derek William Crabb, Dr. G Nerdologist, Dreamer Comics Podcast, Ed Moore at Teal Production, L. Cruz Gonzalez, Inigo Montoya, Fanholes Podcast, Watam Shioran, The Hammer Strikes, Random Geeky Stuff, History of Comics on Film, Iowa's Joe, Jeffrey Brown, Jennifer Ross, John Reed's Comics and Podcasts About Them, Justice First Dawn, Keith G. Baker, Cal Benning Likes Comic, Liz Ann Oswalt, Longbox Crusade, Man Brain Podcast, Mass Design, Max Romero, Michael Allen Carlisle, Mike Peacock, Mike Ratliff, Noel Deal, Odell Abner Dracula, Pat Sampson, Paul Mayberry, Professor Frenzy, Rad Adventures Podcasting Network, Randy the Comic Nerd, Richard Field, Richard G., Robert Romanenko, I think I threw in an extra N, Ryan at Kelton the Cop, Ryan Daly, Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Siskoid, Steve Sellers, Storm Chaser, aka Cupid Cable, Tape Loader, Trekker Talk, and Varangian Vigilante. Rad Adventures came up out of nowhere promoting episodes 3 and 5 of the show, noting that it was a double feature. This one actually featured you, Mr. Illegal Machine, because it was part of the Savage Dragon episode you were part of. Let's see, John Reed's Comics, which is John Wilson, who also does the other Image Comics podcast, All the Pouches, and we kind of feed off each other. He references our show on his. I don't know if you have you ever listened to All the Pouches?
No, I have not yet.
What he does is, instead of putting out a weekly show, he puts out like 3 or 4 episodes all at once at one point in the month. And so I end up listening to like 2 to 4 hours worth of his material. And so trying to find the parts where he talks about us in the midst of all that is pretty difficult. But it's kind of neat because he picks up some information from us, but he's doing things in a very strictly chronological order. He basically, it's like, it's March and here's all the Image Comics that came out in March and I read them and I'm going to tell you about them. Where we seem like we try to avoid talking about the comics as much as possible, to talk about the creators, talk about our feelings, and more we're getting away from a hard line publishing schedule, jump around a little bit. So I think we relate to each other well, and it's nice to have a couple of Image podcasts out there in the sea of all the Marvel and D stuff.
Yeah, for real.
He wrote, "Thank you, I'm only 2 issues away from this in my reading," talking about Cyberforce. He's since covered Cyberforce, I think a couple of issues of it at this point. I had some of the same misgivings about it that we had, unfortunately. Justice First Dawn wrote all of the Chapel episode. "Finished this episode this morning. Trust me, people, this stuff is great." Jeffrey Brown wrote of the episode 14, the Wetworks Ash Can. "Oh, now here we go. I really enjoyed this episode. I really learned some new things about Wills and his early life and career and books he worked on, his part in founding Homage Studios. Wills is an artist I really got into from reading X-Factor and Legion of Night and Wetworks. I like the speed lines he did and how he illustrated movement and action. I mostly enjoy Frank's enthusiastic episodes about early Image comics and also the MCU movies." I think that was, he was promoting like Rolled Spine in general on that last line.
Well, yeah. I mean, why wouldn't he?
So how about you on Wills Prothasco?
I'm a fucking dumbass. What?
What about you? How are you on Wills Prothasco?
He is probably, I don't know if we want to say he's my favorite of the Image artists. There's just something so unique and peculiar about his art that is just so different. I don't know. There's something very different about Wills's art. Even though all the Image guys sort of have a common thread of the way they draw, I don't know. There's something about his art that I thought was always a little bit different that really appealed to me. And then it was kind of funny because then he ended up doing Iron Man, who's my Marvel character guy. This is Iron Man. He did Iron Man for Heroes Reborn. And I don't know, there's something more. It's almost like he's a mix of Jim Lee and Jay Lee. Like, there's something very dark about his artwork that's not as, it's flashy, but it just seems darker. I don't know. There's something about his stuff I just really like. So I've always liked Wills Prothasco, and I did not really understand where he fit in the whole creating Image universe. So that episode was extremely fascinating to me. I learned a lot of stuff I just had no clue about.
Odell Emner Dracula wrote, really interesting episode. Back then, it always seemed like Portacio was second banana to Jim Lee. I didn't know homage was Portacio's deal. His line work had so much more vitality than Lee's. I could never figure out why Lee ascended like he did and Portacio didn't. I wonder if he'd been stateside for the Image announcement, would his trajectory have been different? I also rhetorically wonder if he was treated well when DC slurped up Wildstorm.
Very good question.
Yeah, that gets at least partially addressed to the best of my knowledge in the Wetworks follow-up episode that, you know, it's in the can, but it's not edited in maybe a little bit.
10-4. I will say, I mean, Jim, I mean, you can see why Jim became king shit. I mean, he's Jim Lee. I mean, you look at his Punisher stuff, you look at his X-Men stuff. It's incredible. This stuff is just so fantastic. Whereas, you know, Rob has his quirks. I think Todd was a pretty big deal too. So, I mean, I would say Todd and Jim were kind of side by side. Again, something was just a little different about Wills' stuff, and it may just be the books he got on. He was definitely in Jim's shadow. Maybe they were similar enough that people just appealed to the cleanliness of Jim's stuff compared to the quirkier stuff of Wills's. I don't know what it was, but it always appealed to me. So
part of it is he didn't take the Uncanny X-Men gig when he had the chance. He could have been him doing those Psylocke issues, and that really set Jim Lee on fire. Also, Wills Portacio really doesn't do the whole sexy babe thing, and that's something that Jim Lee is
for. That could be it. Big time. That's a good point.
Jim Lee is just friendlier and flashier and just more accessible. He does that thing like Jose Luis Garcia Lopez where he does this idealized version of the characters. And for me, that's one of the problems I have with Jim Lee's style is I think it's a little plastic. It's a little too pretty, too perfect, too mannequin, I would say. Wills has humanity in his work that I think may be detrimental to his commercial appeal because he doesn't sell himself in the same way.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that for sure.
So Michelle Fife wrote on Facebook this time, just listen to this in-depth episode about one of my favorites, Wills Portacio. Lots of his interviews throughout the years spliced together to make a cohesive origin story. Nicely done, super inspiring. Great episode as usual, gang. By the way, Legion of Night is highly recommended. It's rare horror art from Wills Portacio and Gerber. Story is really good, using quasi-obscure Marvel characters. The fact that this book even existed is weird, though I'm not sure if they were hoping it did well enough to warrant a follow-up. Still worth checking out. Well, you guys still rule. Hats off to Frank wherever he is. And you were actually trying to find that when we were at Dimensions the other day, right?
Yeah. I was curious. I want to check it out.
I found one of the issues. Did you find it or that it wasn't
no,
lost?
No, I never found any of it.
Yeah.
I think you had mentioned that you had seen something in one of the long boxes on one of your prior trips there, but there's a lot of comic books there. So it was just, I didn't see anything when I was going through.
I was trying to see if I could find both of them and I could only find one, so I didn't pick up the other one. And one thing too with Fife is he did a tweet that was promoting the podcast, which is greatly appreciated. And often what I'll do is when it's a promotional tweet, I'll go ahead and tag in people that were involved with that tweet. But there were like 40 some odd people that liked or interacted with that tweet in some way. And so number one, I just think that that'd be a bit much, but also this episode just isn't as good. So I don't know if I want to promote this one as much. This is too much me talking again, which is something I want to make sure we get away from. So Jorge Trejo wrote, I thought Wetworks had the coolest toys of the Image guy. Adrian Johnson, I don't know if he literally meant toys because they had some pretty kick-ass McFarlane toys for Wetworks.
Well, no, I mean, I've got some Wetworks toys. I thought the gold finish they put on them looked really good. I don't know, you know, it didn't look all, you know, if you say, hey, we're going to make a bunch of figures painted gold, you would be like, oh my God, this looks terrible. The way they did the finish on the plastic is really, really good. And they turned out awesome. I've got a couple of them.
I love the werewolf. I've still got my werewolf figure. Just badass. It's such an awesome toy. So Adrian Johnson wrote, jumping in with both feet, Wills is the GOAT, greatest of all time. Listening to the podcast now, you know, Williams really is the yeoman of the crew. Without him and his inking acolytes, that Wildstorm homage look would not have been possible. I don't know any other inker since Williams who has made such an impact. And if they did, they probably came out of Wildstorm like Alex Garner or Travis. Yeah, well, I don't know how much we talked about Scott Williams in that episode. I tried to make sure to get him some attention. He's definitely one of the greatest inkers ever. And again, you know, I don't think you have Jim Lee without Scott Williams' finishes, even though I like Jim Lee on his own, but it's a different look. That polish that people love so much about Lee really comes from Scott Williams. And, you know, you can't say enough about these days, so many pencilers ink their own stuff, or they finish their own stuff, I would say, because I do think there's a lack of that sheen that you used to get from inkers, and I think that you lose some of that synergy from two artists working on the same piece. But Scott Williams is one of the only inkers that are still regularly working on high-profile projects because he's one of the greats.
Yeah, he's a good follow on Instagram, too.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Does he post some of his artwork or other people's artwork?
Yeah, he does. It's great stuff.
And so one thing I wanted to try too, so again, it figures I'd want to do this on the episode where Mr. Fix-It isn't around. And but thankfully, I'm not asking for the answers to this question from anybody, since you probably don't know what fuck we're talking about, since you haven't heard the episode yet. But I want to steal this idea from Waiting for Doom, the Doom Patrol podcast, with some folks that I'm fond of. Even though I'm not super into the Doom Patrol, I mostly listen to DCOCD instead. But they basically, each episode, they ask a question of the audience. So I thought maybe we'd give that a try here. And so if you could retroactively replace one member of Operation Night Strike with any other Image character, who would you choose and why? And I want to know not just who you'd put onto the team, but who you would take out as well.
You're saying who do you take out of Operation Night Strike and replace with like any character?
Any Image character.
Any Image character. Okay.
See, the thing is, again, you haven't heard the episode, so you probably don't know why. It's like, what the fuck? Do you even know what Operation Night Strike is?
No, but I was going to bullshit something if you were putting me on the spot.
Do you know what Team 7 was?
No.
So I'm curious how people would alter the flavor of Operation Night Strike with a swapsie.
A swapsie. That's a weird way to put it.
Hey, kids. Do you like comics?
Uh-huh.
Do you like Iron Man comics?
Uh-huh.
Do you want to learn more about Iron Man's downward spiral from alcoholism, fear of commitment, and feelings of inferiority, leading the egomaniac into a life of misery?
What?
Then listen to the Invincible Ironcast Classics Edition and see Tony Stark go from genius, billionaire, playboy, philanthropist to genius, billionaire, playboy, philanthropist with awesome weaponized armor. Relive classic stories like Demon in a Bottle, Armor Wars, Doom Quest, and more, hosted by me, Mike Staley. So how about it, kids? Do you want to listen to the Invincible Ironcast?
Uh-huh.
Well, too bad. You need to do your homework.
Aww.
The Invincible Ironcast Classics Edition on iTunes or at invincibleironcast.podbean.com.
Tangent, an abrupt change of course. Tangent. To go off suddenly in another direction or on a different line of thought. Tangent, a comic event featuring brand new characters with very familiar names.
I'm waking up to ash and dust. I wipe my brow and I sweat my rust. I'm breathing in the chemicals.
Parallel Lines. The DC Comics Tangent Universe Podcast. Find it bi-weekly on iTunes and at greatkrypton.com. In the Tangent Universe, you only know the names.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to a new podcast here on DCPodcast.com, the Titan Podcast, your podcast for all things related to the upcoming Teen Titans live-action series called Titans on the DC Untitled streaming service. My name is Andy Bebucht. You can call me Andy B. I host one of the longtime podcasts on the network, the Flash Podcast, and I'm going to be co-hosting Titans Podcast as well. I'm joined by my three amazing co-hosts, Miss Kat Kalamia, who does the Legends of Tomorrow podcast and a whole, like, 2 pages long of things on the internet.
Am I supposed to plug everything I do, or
no,
am
no,
I
no,
just...
No, 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 not yet, okay. Not yet. We, no,
all right,
that,
good.
That's for the backstory. That's for our origin story part of the podcast.
Yeah, we'll be here for a while.
And then we also have Ms. Corinne McCreary, who does the Supergirl Power Hour podcast and also awesome stuff on the internet.
Good to be here. I am so excited.
Awesome. And also joining us, last but not least, Miss Amy, whose last name I cannot pronounce, that I've been practicing for a whole week. But we're just going to refer to her as Amy Awesome, who does a lot of awesome things on the internet.
I'm really excited to join you guys, and I think we're going to have a lot of fun. And thanks for listening. Glad you guys are here.
And we'll see you next time on the Titan Podcast.
This is a fan-produced, not-for-profit podcast. No copyright infringement is intended, and any use of copyrighted materials will need to be covered under fair use. If you don't agree, you can go straight to hell!
Fraley.
Is it Ace Fraley? Or
it actually is Ace Fraley. Because I did. I had to do research because
hey,
I wasn't sure.
Welcome to Kissometer. Right.
I actually watched interviews with Ace Frehley, listening to him pronounce his own name, because I didn't know how to pronounce it. I thought it's Frehley personally. Yeah, but it's apparently Frehley.
Spawn.
Wanda!